You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
I don't think anyone should think this is a license to continue to breach copyright. iiNet is not responsible for stopping it.
There's no real demand for censorship of the internet in Australia. There's no other country in the Western world, at least, that's trying anything like this.
Netflix aren't better at anything, but we think we've got something, and we call it the iPad.
And today, we're delighted to be present at the creation of digital radio in Australia.
Senator Conroy is completely botching the implementation of this filtering policy of his.
For adults who want to be able to watch the other material, we're not proposing to do that.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello everybody, I'm Andrew McCollum, and welcome to this week's edition of Tech Talk Radio. According to the Minister for Broadband, Communications and the Digital Economy, Senator Stephen Conroy, Google committed the crime of the century when its camera car sniffed and recorded Wi-Fi traffic of unsuspecting citizens in the moments its car passed any unprotected Wi-Fi network in Australia or around the world. According to the Attorney General's Department, companies who provide customers with a connection to the internet may soon have to retain subscribers' private web browsing history for law enforcement to examine when requested, a move which has been widely criticised by industry insiders. It should be noted that Telstra currently records and stores SMS traffic sent over its network for the same reason. The contents of the SMSs are only stored for a short term, but like phone calls, the details of the A and B parties are recorded and stored for years. Even with the cost-effective data storage of today, it's still impossible to record all content, but this seems like it will change with ISPs. In rather disturbing news this week reported on ZDNet Australia, the Attorney General's Department said that it had been in discussion with industry on implementing a data retention regime in Australia. Such a regime would require companies providing internet access to log and retain customers' private web browsing history for a certain period of time for law enforcement to access when needed. Currently, companies that provide customers with connection to the internet don't retain or log subscribers' private web browsing history unless they are given an interception warrant by law enforcement, usually approved by a judge. It is only then that companies can legally begin tapping a customer's internet connection. The regime being considered by the Australian government could see data held for much longer than the EU directive time of 24 months. It would be more like 5 or 10 years. Internet Industry Association Chief Executive Officer Peter Koronis also confirmed that the industry was having discussions with the Attorney General's Department. He said there had been some preliminary discussions about a proposed data retention regime in Australia, but thinks those discussions are at a very early stage and hadn't seen any firm proposals yet from the government. Electronic Frontiers Australia Chair Colin Jacobs said the regime was a step too far. In February, the Senate passed a bill allowing ISPs to intercept traffic as part of network protective activities. But the questions need to be asked, how far will it go? No other free country is pushing the privacy envelope as much as the Australian government is or has. The US government has voiced its concerns over Conroy's proposed internet filter, as has Google, drawing parallels to China and its internet censorship. All things aside, the questions still need to be asked. Are you happy for the government, or ISPs for that matter, to have a list of all the URLs you've typed into your web browser, or maybe even contents of your email? What's next? Maybe the postie gets to open your snail mail. Has Australia become so paranoid that its citizens will revolt? As we move towards a federal election later this year, maybe this is the straw that will break the camel's back.
This week on Tech Talk Radio,
Apple releases Safari 5 for Mac and Windows. ACMA launches a new spam SMS reporting tool. Windows 7 Service Pack 1 beta is scheduled for July. Google posts Chrome security fixes and Optus Mole's lawsuit over Telstra coverage maps. First up, though, here's the latest from the Tech Talk News Desk with Dr. Ron.
This is Tech Talk News.
This week on Tech Talk News, natural energy to help power exploration of the universe. Charges are possible in the Google Wi-Fi bungle. Australians plan to spend up big on technology to start the new financial year. Aussies click with social networking as use on mobiles booms. And the World Cup causes unprecedented demand for 3D. Welcome to Tech Talk News. The federal government has announced that the CSIRO will receive $47.3 million for the development of solar and geothermal energy technologies to power a radio astronomy observatory and its supporting computer centre. The Sustainable Energy for the Square Kilometre Array, or SKA, will be funded through the sustainability round of the government's Education Investment Fund. The Square Kilometre Array is a global $2.5 billion program to build the world's largest radio telescope. Two sites have been shortlisted to host the telescope, one in Australia and New Zealand, and one in South Africa. The funding will support renewable energy infrastructure projects for the Murchison Radio Astronomy Observatory and the Pawsey High Performance Computing Centre for SKA Science in Perth. CSIRO Chief Executive Dr. Megan Clark said the new project will accelerate the development of renewable energy technologies in Australia. The Pawsey Centre in Perth, co-located with CSIRO's Australian Resources Research Centre, will become one of Australia's largest direct heat geothermal demonstration sites. Researchers plan to address the heating and cooling requirements of not only the SKA data centre, but the entire geosciences facility. They will also conduct research on the performance and longevity of geothermal wells. The Pawsey High Performance Computing Centre for SKA Science will process more data from the SKA every day than is contained in the world's largest library. A British privacy organisation says revelations in a technical audit of a program Google used to scoop up personal information could see the company prosecuted in dozens of countries. Google is under fire in North America, Europe and Australasia after collecting 600 gigabytes of data from unsecured wireless internet connections in as many as 30 countries while taking photographs for its map function Street View. Called GS Lite, the program was created in late 2006 by a Google engineer. It was designed to capture information from wireless networks. The audit by the US digital forensics firm Stroz Friedberg came as New Zealand asked police to investigate the potential privacy breach. Google commissioned an independent audit of the program when it was revealed it had captured the data, and the audit's findings were released on the company's blog last week. In London, Privacy International jumped on the findings, saying it proved Google had intentionally captured personal information. It said, "This analysis establishes that Google did, beyond reasonable doubt, have intent to systematically intercept and record the content of communications." That was a claim challenged by cyber experts, who said it was not yet possible to know if the act was intentional or not. The claim will still be heartening to the Communications Minister, Stephen Conroy, who has referred the matter to the Australian Federal Police and the Privacy Commissioner. But Geordie Guy, a spokesman for the internet rights group Electronic Frontiers Australia, said that despite Privacy International's claim, there was no proof Google had done it intentionally. New research released today by Microsoft Australia has revealed that more than 60% of Australian taxpayers are planning to invest their 2009-2010 tax refunds on technology equipment, and retailers are set to reap the benefits. Microsoft's Tax Time research revealed that 1 in 7 Australians will invest in a new laptop at tax time, while desktop PCs, mobile phones and televisions ranked equally with 1 in 10 votes each. Mr. Jeff Putt, Windows consumer lead for Microsoft Australia.
50% of those we surveyed stated that they wait until tax time to invest in new hardware and software. Overall, though, 60% of Aussies will invest their tax refund in tech gear, with 1 in 7 looking for a new laptop and 1 in 10 a new desktop PC.
Despite the global financial crisis, almost 60% of Australians surveyed plan to spend the same or more on PCs, laptops and gadgets this year as compared to last year, and 50% plan the timing of their technology spend, stating that they will wait until tax time to buy new hardware. Approximately 70% are planning on spending up to $1,500, and 30% are planning on spending upwards of $6,000. Australia's love affair with social networking has gone mobile, with mobile phone users using their phones to visit Facebook, Twitter and MySpace in record numbers over the past 12 months, according to new figures released by Telstra. Mr. Ross Fielding, Executive Director of Telstra Mobility Products, said an increasing number of Australians were accessing social networking sites on their mobiles to stay connected with friends and family on the move. Telstra examined the social networking habits of more than 5 million 3G mobile customers over a 12-month period and found the following: that the number of customers using Facebook on their mobiles has grown almost fourfold since April 2009, that the number of people accessing Twitter on their mobiles each month has grown by by 450% compared with this time last year, that visits to MySpace on mobiles have more than doubled, up 230% over the last year, and that Facebook is by far the most popular social networking destination for Telstra 3G mobile customers, followed by MySpace, YouTube, and then Twitter. Also this week, regional Australians will be among the first to experience Telstra's latest advance in Australia's fastest national mobile broadband speeds when Telstra launches a new mobile device, enabling the doubling of data speeds over the NextG network later this year. Telstra CEO Mr. David Thodey said that 100 regional towns and cities, including Albury, Alice Springs, Orange, Broome, Ballarat, Roxby Downs, Port Lincoln and Newcastle, will benefit from the new 3G modem when it becomes available to customers. Mr. Thodey also announced that Telstra had recently commissioned the company's 7,000th NextG base station, expanding Australia's fastest national mobile broadband network. Last week, Sony Australia announced that due to unprecedented demand, a shipment of its Bravia 3D televisions is being rushed into Australia in time for the 2010 FIFA World Cup. Managing Director, Sony Australia and New Zealand, Mr. Carl Rose.
I think it's going to be massive. Not since colour TV has there been such excitement about anything in home entertainment. I've actually never seen anything like it in my 25 years in the industry. Well, if you think about it, for nearly a century, we've been taking the world we see in 3D, watching it back in 2D. So you could say now technology has caught up with reality. I personally think the arrival of 3D technology in Australia will be remembered as a defining moment in home entertainment in this country.
Attendees at the launch event were treated to a taste of the first Sony 3D music video shot in Australia. Performed by the Rogue Traders and featuring Sydney Football Club team members, the Hearts Beat As One music clip is the Qantas Socceroos 2010 FIFA World Cup anthem. I'm Dr. Ron, and that's your 3D tech update for this week.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
Twas the night before Christmas, and the mouses weren't stirring.
I now have a Q nap.
And I don't even think that message is well understood either.
It's not at all understood, and that's got to get out.
The PS3 is a very, very good Blu-ray player disguised cleverly as a games console.
Yes.
Let's take a step back from that. When was the last time I was on a tram?
Winter is definitely upon us now.
That's not a disadvantage. That's
correct.
Big selling point.
Played with this before, Graham.
Yes.
I seem to recall.
It's been 3 years, thank you very much. What do you mean again? I'd rather not.
You can move office every 5 minutes.
My household has dedicated 6 years to J.J. Abrams' epic drama.
Once again, similar sort of thing to T-versity. Should we talk about politics for a moment, or should we just move on?
This is a bad, 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 bad idea, and you've got to wonder, they can't all be pedophiles.
Mm. Oh.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
It's the Queen's birthday today. Did you know? Where'd you get it, Dr. Ron?
Well, I saw an interesting tweet from, I think it was Will Anderson today.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
he said, I didn't get her anything, but she didn't get me anything for my last birthday. Yeah, but maybe when she turns 100, I'll send her a telegram.
We'll send her a telegram. Yeah. What do you reckon if she makes it that long?
How are you this week, Andrew?
Good, thank you. Thanks, Betty, for the holiday today. It's been fantastic. If you're listening to us on the podcast, we had a holiday last Monday. Which is, it's been a good day today, actually.
I think it was actually Queen Victoria's birthday, but we won't spoil a good joke, will we?
No, let's not let the truth stand in the way of a good story. Hey, the spaceship, as you guys mentioned last week.
Suzuki Motorcycle Spaceship, whatever it was. I remember that from last week.
Hayabusa.
That's the one.
Hayabusa. Did you see the high-def pictures off the... I stayed up last night to try and log into something to watch it happen live, but...
Yeah, because you wouldn't have wanted to watch the soccer, would you?
No, didn't want to go there. Soccer in 3D. The technology is really good to watch Australia. Anyway, we're not a soccer show. You can listen to that on other stations and other times. But
as you say, though, some of the technology is interesting. So I'll talk about that a bit later.
The pictures for the Hayabusa landing in central South Australia, Woomera. About time the government got some bang for their buck up there. They're finally actually using it as a space thing, which is what it was initially built and used for, really.
Stuart Highway Spaceport.
Yeah, that's the one.
Hmm.
Anyway, but the pictures were absolutely stunning. If you want to have a look, if you go to the Tech Talk Radio webpage and on the tweet section, I think it's about the third one down now, there's a link which goes straight to the HD stuff. It takes a while to load because I think everyone in the world's downloading it at the moment, but well worth a bit of a look. So, yeah, there you go. That was the Hayabusa thing that came into land today. Now, Dr. Ron, one of your tweets this evening, please explain. Dr. Ron,
we mentioned
a minister of ours in a tweet who hadn't quite come to terms with unlocking an iPad after his three-year-old locked it on him.
No, I think my tweet said something like, "This is our this is your communications minister. Have a look at this link." I think it was a retweet of Mad Lids.
Lid picked up in Palo Alto.
Lids, our US correspondent, and she posted that on her Twitter feed. And Mr. Conroy can't use his iPhone because his three-year-old daughter's buggered it up.
I see.
And he said, something words to the effect of, my three-year-old daughter's changed some settings and now my iPhone doesn't work anymore and I can't get it working.
This is the same communications minister that doesn't understand the most basic fundamental concepts of web security with SSL.
That's the one.
Him.
Yeah.
That even my elderly mother can understand that SSL, that HTTPS means that nothing can understand it in between you and the bank.
That's it. That's the one.
And yes. So Stephen Conroy just doesn't get it.
He needs a new iPhone now.
Oh, well, just as well.
The least of what he needs.
On top of everything else.
An education. A clue.
Yes.
Something like that.
Being a bit harsh there, I think, Graham, but then again, maybe not. It's interesting to see what the Attorney General's Department came out with. They're looking at mandatorily getting ISPs to actually make a note of all those web URLs that you type into a browser, too. I thought that was... Here we go, Nanny State Plus. It's all early days yet. It's all talk, but gee whiz.
I don't see how that helps anybody. Why would they want to do that?
Allegedly for law enforcement things.
It'd be great for media sales, for storage sales.
Yeah, it'd be good from a sales point of view.
Yeah.
Like a industrial espionage type point of view. But from a law enforcement point of view, they're not actually going to save the content of what's at any of those addresses.
No, they just want to know that you went to dubs.dodgy.com.au.
Exactly.
And they'll go, okay, fine. What did you do there?
Now, if this was a telephone network, you'd need, or even stuff being sent through the mail, you'd need a judge's order to
court
be able
order.
To...
Yeah, that's right.
...to intercept that sort of information. So, doesn't that same apply to the internet?
You would hope, unless they're going to change it, which is what they're talking about.
But that's what they're talking about. Mm. They're talking about intercepting it anyway. This would be like putting a tap on every single phone line.
You look at what they did in the UK.
Just opening everybody's mail and photocopying the contents.
Well, yeah, my gas bill. they did this in the UK not so long back through the House of Commons. They snuck a bill through which allowed peer-to-peer IP addresses handed over to movie houses just by asking for it. So they bypassed any form of court order or anything like that anyone would want to use for getting that information. There goes the privacy type sort of thing. So, goodness me.
I think there's something gone very wrong in the thought process of the people that are coming up with these concepts. And
it's government. It's government. They don't understand. It's knee-jerky and it's just...
But the government used to understand the concept of due process. I've mentioned this phrase before on the show. Due process. It's what we're losing from all of this new... legislation, all of these new ideas to control and regulate us.
chat.techtalkradio.com.au. Come and join the masses that are there tonight. Hello, everybody in the chat. Dark Splat. They've got some great names in our chat there. So all of our regulars are in there. But yes, come along and say good day. And Oil Slick, that's it.
Welcome, Oil Slick.
Slick. He's from BP, obviously. We're going to talk about that tonight, maybe.
Are we going to talk about the fake BP account?
Yeah, absolutely. the BP publicity account that's doing the rounds at the moment, which I thought was quite humorous. Anyway, before we get into the tonight's show proper, let's do what we normally do and hit the corridor. We should get a little theme music thing. This week's Coro, this week's mailbag with Dr. Ron, because there's been plenty as per normal, hasn't there?
There's always plenty. It's good. Thank you for sending in all your mail and your feedback and your correspondence via email this week.
We should do a talkback show one night. Not.
No, let's... It's bad enough as trying to keep control of ourselves, let alone having other people. Yes, that's right, ringing in live. Hello to Ray via email. Ray says, firstly, I've listened to the podcast for some time, usually on my iPod on the bus to work. I find it very informative and interesting. Thanks, Ray. I'm glad you enjoy the show.
Hi, Ray.
He gets all of his tech news and finds information. I find the amount of information on the internet overwhelming and so rely on the podcast for latest info. Well, that's good. We find it a bit overwhelming too, Ray. It's part of our sheltered workshop therapy session once a week. We come in here and we talk about everything. We try and hash it out and make some sense of what's going on. Secondly, recently there's been discussion of boxes that connect to the home network that allow you to view stored videos and watch video sites such as iView. I have a Panasonic Blu-ray DVR, and the model number he's got here is DMR-BW850, which is a Panasonic model. Already,
so would not be looking at the PlayStation PS3, which I believe, from the discussion on Tech Talk Radio, would allow me to connect to the home network. Could you give me an idea of what I should be looking at to provide this functionality for me, and what sort of cost would be involved? Thanks again, from Ray.
Well, as we've been discussing, Ray, Adam Turner is probably the guru here in all respects. A couple of his chats recently to Sony and the likes give you a fair indication of what the manufacturers are up to. But yeah, in essence, I guess there's two things that we, as in the panelists here at Tech Talk Radio, tend to use. One device, which is a Western Digital device, these people make hard drives, is called the, what's it called again, Dr. Ron? I'm trying to think of
it's called a WDTV Live.
That's it. I always get the, yeah. And there's a few flavors of it out there. There's a not so live, and there's a live version. Now, that's a box which, in essence, has an HDMI output which plugs into your flat screen, your flat panel television set.
But if you don't have a flat panel television set, it also has an old composite output or an RGB.
It's got all the good things.
All the different outputs, component out for your different types of TVs.
So it caters for all technologies.
Mm.
And this device in itself will look at things like, such as, you know, a shared storage arrangement or a shared device on your laptop, PC, your home system, whatever you've got. And that's one way of pulling data across, and that's fairly cost effective. I think it's about $150.
About $199, I think.
Oh yeah, yep. $190. Sub $200.
It was $199 when I bought mine quite some time ago, so it might have even come down.
So that's one of the options that you can do. The other one which we've been talking about recently is obviously the PlayStation 3 device, which I think if you heard the teaser coming into tonight's show, Graham said it, and both of you actually said it was a Blu-ray center disguised as a games console or something like that. They're a terrific device. Once again, you get all the outputs that you would want and need. The benefit over the PlayStation as opposed to the WDTV Live is that it actually allows you to obviously play games, which you can't do on the other device. It's probably a fraction more. Comes with a built-in hard drive, so you can actually download stuff. It won't record a television
show. Built-in Blu-ray player.
Built-in
Blu-ray
player. Big
feature of the Sony PlayStation.
Absolutely. But once again, it's all network aware. It's either you can either connect it with a cable or without a cable into your network, which is pretty good for some people because they don't have the old blue cable, the old Ethernet cable to their media center or to where the TV is. Anyone building a house these days, for goodness sakes, build it straight to the back of your television set. I've actually even got a hub underneath my you know, the cabinet where you keep everything.
That's a sensible idea.
I've actually got one port and then a hub, which goes, one goes to the Blu-ray player, one goes to the PlayStation, one goes to the television set, you know, it's, and one to the WDTV Live. So there you go, four I've got in my media center at the moment. But that's the other one. The PlayStation 3 is a really good option. You'll spend probably twice the amount of money on that, unless you buy, I think Sony have got a deal at the moment, buy a screen and they throw one of these things in. And that's a good option because it does handle iView Live, so you can play ABC straight to your flat screen if that's your want.
Ray, the thing here is that we need to find something which is an interface between your computer network and your television and your sound system in your living room. And we're talking about the Western Digital device. We're not being paid by Western Digital or anything. We just like to mention it because it's a good unit. And
everybody here has one.
We use them. Yeah,
exactly. We use them.
But, Ray, there are other models and other similar things out there. Hang around and wait for the gadget this week because there's a similar new gadgety gadget coming up as the gadget of the week.
So a gadgety gadget.
There is a gadgety gadget, which will be on a little bit later. But thanks for the email, Ray. TD on the forum says, "Hi, guys, on episode 23
last week,
Andrew mentioned that he uses a program to download iView programs.
I use a plugin.
It was a Firefox extension, I think. And we just had a comment in the chat too, Andrew, from Damo the Greek, who says, what's the name of the Firefox plugin to save the iView file? Do you have any details or links to this? TARDIS3 answered. Yes, he answered the question, I think. Keep typing and we'll keep talking amongst ourselves. TARDIS3 says, was an excellent view from the couch, which is great. Thanks, TARDIS. I tell lies. TARDIS goes off on a tangent about something else. Smoked Salmon said, iView Fox. Is that the one, Andrew?
That's it, iView Fox. It's a plug-in.
iView Fox is great. So there you go, TD, and there you go, Damo.
And that'll drive you crazy if you... it goes into Firefox, and it basically just downloads it instead of playing it to your screen. So go and watch it. If you want to watch it on your computer, load up Chrome or something like that and watch it on Chrome. Now, the other thing, too, I will say... there is another program which does it called iView Napper, which is not as simple as the plugin for Firefox, but iView Napper will also drag down and store an MP4 for you of all the programs that you said choose to want to watch said iView.
I wonder if there's a Chrome plugin, because Chrome does plugins now.
Maybe.
It does.
Our chat people will no doubt get out there and do
somebody
a search.
Will know.
Smoke Salmon says, you get it via Firefox, go to Tools, then Add-ons. It's great for putting new shows or documentaries onto your netbook. The 3G modem would get too expensive to do this. I use iiNet. However, you have to go via ABC's iView site. It will not work via iiNet's free zone link.
Hang on. Oh, no. No, you got to use it via the website. Hey, I also used this whilst I was in the United States for watching local television remotely too. Very handy.
Ah. That's a good tip.
So, yeah, I just VPN'd into one of my work servers and downloaded it to my
VPN.
Local...
and then, pardon me. VPN is virtual private network.
It is.
So and... you had a secure... Pardon me, secure connection from overseas,
yep.
As if you were on your own network in your office.
That's right. Just yep. Download it and pulled it back across to whilst I was sitting in the living room in the States to watch latest run things and what was on iView, because you can't normally see it because it's IP blocked.
Well, I hope that answers your question, TD and Damo as well. Now, Tata said he was talking about the last episode, 23, excellent view from the couch, said Tarnas, about the raw deal that Aussies get from free-to-air TV.
Absolutely.
And how exciting the finale of Lost was to see. Well done, Adam Turner. Your segment was a highlight of the show. That's very nice. Thanks, Tardis. I think Tardis is in there tonight in our chat room too somewhere.
But it's so true how contemptuous some of these networks become. The only people who don't do that, and I'm probably out of line here, someone will shoot me down, is the ABC tend to let everything run its own length. It's just the commercial guys that do really strange...
Well, didn't Justin have a gripe about the ABC with some old program he was trying to catch up on?
Oh, Brideshead Revisited. Yeah. Yeah, he did, but I wouldn't worry about that.
Oh, okay.
Anything more modern than that, you know. But yes, it's...
Sorry, JD, your complaint doesn't count.
For those of you just catching up about the... go and have a listen to it. It's on the podcast last week. Download it. Be one of the many thousands of people that download it. We were all shocked this week to see our download stats, but that was really good. Thank you. Keep downloading them.
It's great to know all those people are out there listening to the show.
Absolutely. What was I going to say? Yes, go and have a listen to last week's show, but yeah, it is... a lot of people are frustrated, especially with closing things that end up being put in credits. It's like, you know, when you go to see like Toy Story in the movies and you got to hang around to watch the credits because they have all the funny bits.
Mm.
Well, imagine if Channel 7 just squashed it up, went 10,000 kilometres an hour, made, you know, fast forwarded it, and then that's it, 30 seconds. You miss all the good fun parts. You'd be dark. And that's what a lot of the Lost viewers were. So, hence Australians go to peer-to-peer in their droves. That's what last week was about, but go and have a listen.
Oil Slick in our chat room says, don't the producers of MasterChef know that TikTok radio is on Monday at 8 p.m? Yeah, obviously they don't, Oil Slick. They're going to be losing hundreds of thousands of viewers on television.
Maybe that's that could explain why the podcasting has soared.
I quite like MasterChef. It's probably one of the only...
Disaster Chef.
I haven't heard that one. It's very funny. It's probably one of the
Russell Gilbert did that one on one of the old reunion Hey Hey's.
Did he? Yeah. It's one of the few reality type things that I like to watch, quite enjoy watching.
Do you watch that?
Yeah, occasionally. Why? Occasionally. It's entertaining.
You should get Debbie Anker in from The Green Guide. Why is it entertaining?
We've got to get rid of Joanne. Joanne's the... Everyone hates Joanne. She's got to go.
Who's Joanne?
She's one of the contestants, and she's still on. It's been weeks and weeks and months coming, but she's
still
there.
I'm very, very disappointed in you, Dr.
Are you?
Yes. I would have expected better.
It's one of the few that I do watch, but it's quite entertaining. And you look at the recipes, you look at what they're cooking.
Oh,
and it's,
for goodness. Moving on.
Oh, that's good. Isn't that great?
You'll start them in the chat now. Any other Coro before we...
No, that's enough. I think that'll do. Enough for 1 week.
Can I just give a quick cheerio to Claire listening in Sydney?
Hi, Claire. How you doing?
Hi, Claire.
And to my mum listening in hospital.
Hi.
Hi, mum.
Mrs. Graham's mum.
Dr. Graham's mum. Yeah, good. Hope you get better soon. Anyway, yes, stick with us for a bit of fun and frivolity as we try and dissect what technology things have occurred since we've been on air last week. Now, one thing that did happen at the very... when you get in the Wayback Machine and go way back to last Monday night, after we got off air, Steve Jobs took the stage in San Francisco.
Yeah,
WWDF happened.
And, much to everybody's surprise, he announced a new iPhone.
Really? That was surprising, wasn't it? Anyway, yes, the new iPhone.
Oddly enough, the very same iPhone we'd all seen before.
What on Gizmodo got?
Anyway, we've got some nice high-res pictures out of their media centre at the moment now, so we can adorn those across websites and things like that. But
I must admit, when it does become available, I'll be looking closely at it.
Look, I think there's got a lot of things going for it. One of the show's people who were on before us, as they walked out the door tonight, said, oh, what do you think of the new iPhone? I said, well, it's a bit early stages yet. We haven't really actually seen one hands-on just yet, but... from all intents and purposes, if you're into video calls and things like that, well, there's a little camera in it, and obviously it does multitasking better, but we'll wait and see what all the other bits and pieces does. New screens, new res, faster machine, all that sort of stuff.
I think my Sony Ericsson handset had a forward-facing camera in 2004. 2005.
Yeah, the forward-facing camera is probably not going to be my favourite feature of it. Don't make a lot of video calls.
Others would, I guess. Some interesting news about Apple during the course of the week as well. Just to put the company into perspective, I think about 2 weeks ago they took over Microsoft in the rungs of most expensive, what's the word for it? If you're going to buy the company today.
Most valuable technology company.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, they managed to crack $222 billion the other day as opposed to Microsoft's net worth of around $119 billion. Which all got a bit, hush-hushed by Microsoft. But anyway, in the last year, the last financial or fiscal year for Apple, they did rather well. If you want to have a look at their revenue streams, their total revenue was $29.182 billion in sales.
Mm-hmm.
Not bad for a couple of boys in an Apple box, really.
Billion with a B.
Billion dollars, yep. Now, of that, call it 30 bill for round numbers because, we're amongst friends here. The iPhone basically catered for 11 billion of that. So a third of their income comes from one device, which is the iPhone. Their computer sales is sort of just marginally underneath that. 28% of that is $8.2 billion. And then underneath that, the ubiquitous iPod. And I wonder if iPod sales have slumped with the iPhone out because it's all built in these days. Because the iPod was out for years before the iPhone ever came out, and it did gangbusters for these guys. But now, with the iPhone out, I wouldn't think so at all.
I would think that iPhone sales would be going strong, particularly with some of the smaller models that are so easy to carry around.
And so you like the little green and silvery metallic things?
Well, look, I haven't got one. I must admit, my iPod is actually an iPod Classic, but I can certainly see the attraction of it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, that's good. Anyway, the iPod's sitting in there 18% of its revenue, and that just bundles in 16% of other things, which I'm assuming will be things like app stores and all those sort of things.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other gadgets that they sell, accessories and things like
that.
And
what percentage is actual, iMacs and Macintoshes and,
well, the computers,
and OS X's and things?
Well, the computer section is 28.1%. So
less than a third.
Yeah. Now, let's put this into global perspective in mobile phone devices or operating systems in particular, and have a look at the global market share. Now, Symbian, which is in pretty much everything, well, nearly everything, your Nokias and things like that, it has 46.9% of market share. So just marginally under half of the world's mobile phones is running on the Symbian operating system.
And having used it for quite a while on my current Nokia phone, I can take it or leave it.
Yeah, there's nothing flash about it, is it? It's just an operating system.
It's just firmly entrenched. It's been around for years and years and years. So that's probably what's got the market saturation that it does.
Second to that, have a guess.
No, surprises.
You want a surprise, do you?
Yeah, yep.
BlackBerry, RIM.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Research in Motion is 19.9 or 20% of the market.
Not really a surprise.
Well, one of the things I noticed when I was in the United States, you know how here in Australia you walk around the street and everyone's got an iPhone? In the United States, everybody's got a BlackBerry.
Yeah, there's something going on with the popularity of the BlackBerry.
That was a month ago.
if I could say so, I suspect this won't offend too many of our listeners because I suspect our listeners are amongst the ones that would know better.
You be careful.
And I think that, the BlackBerrys are very popular amongst those that don't know better.
Brian in our office has got a BlackBerry.
Oh, sorry, Brian.
No.
Hi, Brian.
I didn't mean to offend.
He gave his iPhone to his sister. But anyway.
Oh, I see.
People that use BlackBerrys love them.
Can we read that as his sister took his iPhone off him?
Yeah, I would.
They rave about them.
They do, don't they?
Yeah.
It's very strange. I can't see the attraction myself.
No. And I've tried to pick up a BlackBerry before and use it and experiment with it.
You're going to start a rebellion on the chat.
And did it end up embedded in a wall?
Almost. Yeah, it did. And I was like, I couldn't work out the keypad and the way that it was laid out just wasn't intuitive. But the people that have them, they pick them up and they say, no, you just use it and you'll just get the hang of it and it'll all just become second nature, and people who use them absolutely love them. But I couldn't take to it. No, it didn't do anything for me. Maybe I had to persevere with it a bit more. I don't know.
Well, it's like any new device, isn't it? whether you get an iPod or an MP3 player, absolutely. Really, you've got to sit and fiddle with it for a while.
And you do become used to the idiosyncrasies of a particular user interface.
Absolutely, yeah, yes.
But I
yes.
just couldn't quite tune into
this. This is where Apple have been very smart, using the same user interface across the iPod Touch, the iPhone, the iPad.
Yeah, that's right.
And the same user interface going back a long way with the iPod, with the wheel and the you know,
the click wheely thing.
The click wheel thing that goes back a long way, yeah. It's a very sensible, you know, to keep that same feel through things.
All right, so just recapping what we're talking about, the global market share of operating systems on mobile telephones. Symbian was 46.9. RIM, which is what we were just talking about, the BlackBerrys, sits in at 20%. Sitting underneath that at 14.4% is Apple. Apple, the OS X version, or the OS version, is currently 14.4%, ahead of Microsoft at 8.7% for its Windows 7 Mobile, or Windows Mobile 7, or whatever it's called today.
Yeah.
Because I think they rename it regularly, don't they?
They do rename it regularly.
They just renamed it recently after a long run of calling it whatever they were calling it.
Windows Mobile. Yeah. Mm. But to be fair, the low share of that is because it's only just sort of starting to become available on a few devices. It hasn't been around...
Yeah,
very much. That might change dramatically in a few months.
So Microsoft sitting at number four. Number five in the world is Linux, 4.7%. Then the dark horse coming up very closely at 3.9% is Android. You've got to bear in mind that Android's only been in the marketplace for a very short period of time compared to a lot of other of these devices. So Google's Android sitting there, 3.9%, not much to go to catch up with Linux. Mm. Or Microsoft for that, just a... another operating system or something, a new HTC release might kick them along a bit more.
And there's about, what, 1% other or something, is there?
Yeah, the other 1.3%.
Oh, for a I'm good surprised that Linux comes in that high.
Are you?
Yeah. I am. I'm surprised that Android's that low. I would have thought they'd have a bigger penetration a lot faster than...
With the number of
HTC devices.
HTC devices sold with it, yeah.
Yeah, just in the last couple of years. I would have thought that Android would be up around where Microsoft is at 8.7, but it's still half of that.
All right, just to clarify our sources there, this comes from Apple and through Reuters, the news source, where that data came from. So,
what Linux-based platforms are there for mobile devices?
I'm not entirely sure. I'm a bit surprised by that statistic. Mm. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. I am. I'm scratching my head. I can't think of anything that's branded up as a Linux operating system that's used widely. Certainly, obviously, more than Android. That surprises me.
They must have had an unusually high number of hackers in their survey.
I think so, yes. You've got to look at the audience that they polled, don't you?
So Steve got up on stage last Monday night. I think it was Tuesday morning our time by the time he did it. And he basically, I think that there wasn't really any surprises apart from the iPhone, which wasn't a surprise because everyone had seen it beforehand. But they did crystallize a few of the things it was going to come with. First and foremost, the camera, which everyone was talking about, the forward-facing camera, no longer limited to a tiny 3.2 megapixels. The iPhone 4 comes with 5 megapixels.
That's not the forward-facing camera. That's the main camera.
Okay, and LED flash. So it comes with a flash as well. So
I thought you weren't allowed to have flash.
That's what
on
I thought. That's going to support flash, is what you're saying.
Now, there's a pun on words, isn't it?
Sorry.
Yeah, it is going to support flash.
A photographic flash.
Yes. And Steve says it'd never work.
Yeah.
All right. Apple calls this a huge step forward with the company just really playing catch-up. So I don't know whether it's a revolution. It's probably just a point upgrade in a lot of respects, hardware-wise and software-wise. So, obviously, we're going to start seeing apps come out for it, which may or may not utilize some of the new gadgetry in there. Obviously, yeah.
And, of course, it's not just the iPhone 4, but it's also Operating System 4, which will be available for the previous versions, particularly for the 3GS.
They're calling it iOS 4, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, iOS 4. 720p video camera in there as well.
So if you've got 3GS, you can get the upgrade that allows you to do the multitasking. And I think the lower ones don't have quite enough guts to run the multitasking part of it.
Is that done through iTunes, the operating system upgrade?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, everything's done through iTunes. That's the store.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, allegedly it's going to be cheaper than the old 3GS and a little slimmer in its style. Wonder how it handles battery. They didn't really go into that. So, and scheduled for an Australian release around July. So you've got a month to go. Mm. And that was really the WWDC. If Justin was here,
and
he'd be able to let us know.
Freak in the chat making the point that the really big feature change is the improved battery life, which was a big...
Oh, there is a battery life thing. Oh,
which was a big sticking point with the 3GS, people getting a full day out of it.
Yeah, you're lucky to get a day out of it.
People like me who've been holding back and sticking with their Nokia, it might just be time to have a look.
Well, if you're going to go down the
iPad... If you've already got a 3GS or something like that, then, yeah, maybe just stick with it, but...
No, you hand it down to the next of kin.
Right, okay, yeah.
Yes.
Hand me down phones, yeah, that'll work.
Correct. Because it's got a music player in it, the kids will love it, even the missus will like it.
Hmm.
She still hasn't worked out, she's got one of those little plugs in the car to plug it into a stereo system.
She'll
work it out.
Yeah.
The day she sells it.
And if you're in a corporate environment, it's hand me up. Do you give the old one to the CEO who can't use it, doesn't use it?
Oh, is that how it works?
Depends on the organisation.
But yes, as you were saying before, if you're looking to buy into the Apple range of devices, the iPad, the iPhone, they do tend to complement each other. Obviously, I don't know what it's going to be like in the next little bit with the new versions coming out, but the jailbreak options certainly do put a lot more value into phones. It also opens up a few issues, but nonetheless, I think the advantages certainly outweigh the disadvantages. And may I also say, the new iPad application for the Australian Broadcasting Commission, or is it Corporation? I always get it wrong.
Corporation these days.
Corporation these days?
Yes, you may say, because you were showing it before the show, and it looks really impressive.
Yeah, you'll find that if you hit the App Store, be sure to read what... there's two panels that sort of present. They present, like if you search for ABC, for example, you'll see the iPad stuff on the top and the iPhone stuff at the bottom. The iPhone stuff will work on the iPad. It's just a tad small. So you get a little buy two button to magnify it up and it pixelates a little bit. But the ABC have released they still do have an iPhone version of their news and videos which stream direct to your device. But now they've got one for the iPad. And might I say, it is a fantastic interface between... it's just a really good way of watching video content, listening to streamed audio, and reading a newspaper or reading news all in the one app. It's not a web browser.
Well, why wouldn't you just go to the website?
Why wouldn't you?
What does it do that the ABC website doesn't do natively?
Well, it's probably a bit more easier to navigate. It's simpler to navigate.
It doesn't do anything the ABC website doesn't do natively. It just does it on a platform that you're carrying with you.
And it's a presentation. It's got the really, you know, the movie slide up and you can play and you can pause and you can go back. And, oh, it's just a really nice interface. That's all of which
the main site does do. It's just that it looks really good and it works really well on the iPad. It's a great use for the technology.
Yep, and it's really good because it's the always-on device in the kitchen table in the morning. You can just push the button, check the 90 seconds of news that they have, look at the weather, and you're done. Well, you can't even do that without booting up.
I came to the studio straight from a previous appointment. I'd missed all the news and so on, and I'm standing in the foyer with Andrew watching the 7:30 report. It's brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
There you go. All right, that was WWDC for 2010. What's next? Who knows? I don't know who's got the next big launch or anything like that. Maybe it's Microsoft's turn. They've got to get out there and have a bit of a go.
No, they've just done their Windows Mobile 7, whatever it's called.
Oh, they just changed the name, didn't they?
No, launched a new version.
Phone 7.
Yeah.
Phone 7. Oh. Well, let's talk while we're talking about Windows. Windows 7, SP1, Service Pack 1, Beta.
Oh, yes.
Scheduled for next month. Oh, it's all going to happen. Probably the same day that Apple release
iOS 4.1 or something.
Yeah.
good news and bad news here. This is probably the update a lot of people have been waiting for, because a lot of people wait for Service Pack to come out before they start deploying it in a corporate environment. But Microsoft are also doing their bit to try and push people in that direction. When Service Pack 1 hits, then Windows 7 Business... or Professional, what's it called? Windows 7 Professional, whichever it is.
Professional. Yep.
Will no longer have downgrade rights to Windows XP.
I'd like to talk about XP.
What does that mean?
Down the track,
at the moment, if you buy a new computer with Windows 7 pre-installed and it's the business version, it's Windows 7 Professional,
yep,
you have the right to install Windows XP Professional on that machine under that license.
Right.
That's what they call downgrade rights. Or Vista, but why would you?
Yep. Yeah, you wouldn't. Yep.
What was that? What operating system was that?
Yeah. and the reason why that's useful is because a lot of corporate environments, even fairly small ones, business environments, aren't yet geared up and the support services aren't ready, and we're just not quite sure about running Windows 7 on those environments, yet we're very comfortable with Windows XP. So we can run Windows XP on those machines. And yet, when the time comes and we are comfortable with Windows 7, we can move to it because we've got the license for it. Now, Microsoft are taking that away, as I understand it, and I hope I'm speaking correctly here, because I haven't double-checked this before I came to here, but Microsoft taking this away as of Service Pack 1.
Okay.
So that when Service Pack 1 comes out...
You're committed. If you've got the license key to install Windows 7 Professional, that's what you're installing.
That's what you're using, yep. And so hopefully...
I think that's a good thing from a personal user point of view.
There's a good side and a bad side to it, yeah. And yeah. It'll force a lot of us to go, oh yeah, now we are going to have to start connecting our Windows 7 devices to our domains.
We are going to have to commit... But it's a good thing. I'm enjoying using Windows 7. It's a great operating
system. I'm loving Windows 7 on my own machine, but I haven't used it in a domain context that much yet. So that's one yet to play with.
I've been using it quite nicely with Windows 7 and Server 2008, which has been...
Joined to the domain?
Yeah, joined to the domain. And it looks after a lot of things like security issues and patches and updates and stuff like that, which is great for those who don't know how to do it.
So you're running a WSUS server on your domain?
Yep.
Yeah, which is the Windows Server Update Services.
Yes, it does all of that. You can actually
download your Windows updates through your company server and allows you, your network administrator at the company, to control which updates you get and when you get them.
That's exactly right.
And which is really good.
Works quite nicely. But we won't get into that detail here because I don't think that's right for our show.
Sorry.
But what I would like to ask is the migration of 32-bit to 64-bit machines, because this is the dilemma you will have when you install your Windows 7. Because traditionally, if you're an XP user, you'll be in a 32-bit domain unless you've had cores with software that you're running to load up the 64-bit version. Now, in a professional capacity the other day, I was forced to load up Windows 7 64-bit. Otherwise, the software that I had would not run in the 32-bit version. It'd come up, but it didn't function properly. And on a quick telephone call to my guru who knows these things, he said, "You're running 64-bit on that machine?" I said, "No." Nah. So, okay, good, blow it away, start again.
So that's an unusual situation where your application requires 64-bit. A lot of people will be in the reverse situation where they've got hardware like printers or cameras or other things that are attached to their machine that they need to use to function, and they won't have 64-bit support, or they've got...
And that was going to be my question, Graeme, just because you're at the coalface in a lot of these respects. I just did it because I had to. I was forced to with the software that I needed to run on it. And fortunately, all the other software that I had to load subsequently on the new install, such as the graphics packages and things like that, all worked beautifully in the 64-bit domain.
Well, a 64-bit will run a 32-bit virtual machine if it needs to run older applications that aren't 64-bit. So you'll find that you'll get a program files folder, and you'll get a program files
32 or whatever
folder that will have the older applications in that don't support it. So it deals with the application side of it pretty well. It's the hardware drivers and things that the Windows XP days used to be a really big worry. I think nowadays
I don't think it's a problem at all.
It's becoming a lot more well supported.
Warlock in our chat says 32-bit apps tend to work well on Windows 64. I'd have to concur with that. The other thing that I really like about Windows 7 is you know when you plug something exotic into your device and it says I don't have a driver and do you want me to go online and look for it?
Yeah, and
that actually works.
In Windows XP, you'd click on that, and it'd sit there for 45 minutes and then come back and say it couldn't do it. Whereas in Windows 7...
It actually works.
Yeah, it's phenomenal.
Absolutely amazing. Yeah. So I think if you're brazenly going forth and building a new machine for work, or even home, Graham, what would you do? 32-bit or 64-bit with today's...
I must admit, mine at home is 32-bit because I only had 4 gig in my machine.
Warlock in the chat.
But I strongly suspect my next machine will be 64-bit.
Yeah. I'm just going to ask, as my battery, I'm not running on batteries tonight on the laptop here.
Oh.
So it dies every so often. Warlock in the chat, are you running 32 or 64? Warlock's just saying, program files bracket x86. So.
That's the one, yep.
So I must admit, I wouldn't think twice now about loading up the 64-bit version. I think at home, or I'm running 32-bit at home, but I'm running 64 at work. So.
Mm. Yeah, no, and... The big restriction is with Windows with 32-bit, the older versions, you had a limit of how much memory it could address, which was around 4 gigabytes. And
if you're lucky.
Well, and that doesn't include the addresses it needs to reserve for certain special functions, which is more complex than we need to go into, so it could never even quite use the 4. But that was the maximum number of addresses it could talk to. Whereas the point of the 64 is it breaks that limit. So you can have much, much more memory in your machine. You can have 12, 24 gig of memory in your machine.
Well, there you go, people at home. If you're doing graphic-based things or memory-hungry tasks on your machine.
Or you want to run virtual machines, which I want to do.
Yep. I'd seriously consider 64-bit. And Warlock has answered the question. He's running 64-bit always.
So yeah.
There you go. All right.
Definitely the way of the future.
So your Windows 7 SP1 Service Pack 1 scheduled for July. There goes the bandwidth. Make sure you're not on a mobile network when you do that. Otherwise, next year you'll be pulling down gigabytes of stuff when you'll be in for bill shock.
Do you know off the top of your head, Graeme, do we have to actively go and get Service Pack 1 for Windows 7, or is it going to get pushed down with updates?
It will be an update.
Yeah, I don't think it's been announced yet, but at the moment you would have to go and get it because it's only a beta release.
Yeah, yep.
Unless you've... you'd have to go and get it to get the beta release. But I'd say initially it'll be released so that you have to go and get it, but it will eventually appear in the Windows updates, yes.
Good to hear.
Just also another thing too, the service pack, which will also cater for Windows Server 2008 Release 2, will prepare users for cloud computing. So there you go. Everyone's going to... We're going to end up in the clouds very shortly if we're not there already. Just hope it doesn't rain too bad.
Now, can I ask you something else about your... You said about Windows 7 in your business network where it connects to your server.
Yep.
Now, in Windows 7, there's a concept of libraries that replace the old My Documents concept.
I like libraries.
Yeah. How does that integrate?
I don't use it.
You don't use that feature. No. Okay. That's the one thing that I'm really keen to play with.
Yeah.
Because in theory, you should be able to have, say, a documents library on the server that integrates into your library on your machine, and you have your own documents and the server's documents, and they all sort of merge together. So should be very,
one of the
very
things
interesting and very useful to play with.
Which doesn't
normally... Much easy to find things.
One thing that does normally in the server thing is that when you log in as a general office person, like whoever you might happen to be, it shares your desktop with other machines, but it loses the icons. Anyway, but that's another story for another time down the track. But, yeah, I'll talk to you about that off air.
Okay.
All right.
I think I know what's going on there, by the way.
Do you? Oh, excellent. Because it means you can install, like, if you've got a laptop and you install something on the laptop, it also appears on your desktop, but it's got a generic icon there, which...
Because the icon, it redirects the desktop folder to the server.
Yes, it does.
So you have the same desktop on each machine, but because you've got different... you've got a shortcut to a program that doesn't exist on that other machine, the shortcut will be broken.
Correct. Yeah.
If you had the same software installed on every machine, like you would in a lot of corporate environments, that would work seamlessly.
There you go. See, there's an answer for everything. Before we go and have a break and come back for View for the Couch, which is a very interesting view for the couch this week, Adam is talking about the New York Times and some iPad applications and things like that. I'd just like to go to the break with a sort of an odd spot bit of humory sort of thing, which I couldn't believe it when I read it. But Hewlett Packard is going to give printers an email address. Now, I thought instantly, this has got to be great news for spammers. they can spam straight to the printer and it'll come out. So you'll go to get your print run out of the local office printer or something like that, and you're going to have your Viagra printed out for you.
Well, printers and scanners have been able to send email for a long time, but this is so they're going to be able to receive email, are they? So you can send a message to it via email and it will print or store.
Even receiving it isn't revolutionary. A lot of office-level photocopier printer combinations can already do that.
Mm.
You can email them on the internal network.
What's this going to do, Andrew?
The benefit of this is, as Hewlett Packard was saying, is you can actually print without a driver, which could also eliminate some of the X64 problems you might be having with older printers and things like that. But the ePrint system essentially allows prints to be delivered in just the same way as an email message. So you'll just send a printer on your email, I guess, from wherever you might happen to be. You could be in a meeting, you could be on the other side of the world, or you could be right next to the printer and you can still send and do a print job. So it may be good.
Oh, like an attachment or something.
Yeah, but if like everyone has mail and everyone has info at their domain name, people might start having printer one at their domain name and that'll be just tantamount for a spammer.
That's right. Printer at techtalkradio.com.au and it'll start spitting out spam.
Absolutely.
There's plenty of companies already out there wasting our printer paper in our fax machines doing exactly
that. You've got a good solution
to that,
Dr. Ron, haven't you?
No, I have.
Do tell the listeners how to fix people that like sending you faxes.
Back in the good old days of when the fax machine actually just printed out paper and that was about as complicated as it got. Yeah, I had a spammer sending me spam on the fax machine. It was a computer company and they were trying to sell me laptops, and every day they'd send a 4 or 5 or 6 page fax to my fax machine with their daily specials. And I rang them up and I faxed them back and I called them and said, stop sending me this garbage. You're just wasting paper. I don't want to get this information. Take me off your list. And they didn't listen to me. So one day they sent me through their spam, and I just started to fax it back. And while it was faxing back to them on the fax machine, I looped it round and I sticky taped it into an endless loop and let it run for half an hour or 45 minutes. So I must have sent about 800 pages back to them and then pressed the stop button. And then I never got another fax from them again.
Of course, the real solution is to have your faxes arrive in your email inbox.
Yeah, well,
which is a much more sensible solution.
You should have unified messaging, Graham.
Better solution is just to ditch fax.
Yeah, you can't.
I know it's old technology and I know you hate it, but you can't. There's too many people out there that still use it.
Someone rang and said, can I send you a fax? I laughed at them the other day. I said, a what?
A lot of businesses don't have the luxury to be able to do that. A lot of businesses need to be able to communicate with suppliers that are bigger than them or customers that are less technologically advanced than them. And you just don't have a choice. You've got to be able to support faxes.
But also what Graham's saying is correct as well. You can take fax from being a dumb system whereby you just pick up pieces of paper off a machine to actually having it integrated in your communications. You can have it electronic in your network. You can have the documents scanned in. You can have them accessible from a computer and you can manage
them
properly.
And I'll tell you what, it's a whole lot more satisfying when you get that 5-page advertisement coming in your fax machine to just go shift delete, gone.
Gone. That's no wasted
paper, no wasted ink, no wasted time, just gone.
Can I ask a question, you fax gurus? How does fax go with VoIP? Can you actually run a VoIP number with a fax?
There is a protocol called fax over IP.
Oh, really?
Mm, so you can send fax messages over IP.
See, I knew I had to ask that question.
VoIP, it's called.
All right, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. If you'd like to communicate with us, chat.techtalkradio.com.au. We're all in there at the moment, so come and ask your questions. You might be a faxer from way back. We'll try the chat. It's a little bit less harmless, and no paper can be harmed in any way, shape, or form. So there's that way. Or if you like, you can communicate with us via email on the website at techtalkradio.com.au. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Adam Turner's going to have his view from the couch, and we're going to be talking about the New York Times. Do you read that paper at all online?
New York Times.
Very good. I use it for research and stuff like that. Yeah. Very good. Anyway, they've done a very, very interesting things with their app in the App Store, and we'll be back with that after this.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show.
Tech Talk Radio.
Android-powered, flash-enabled devices. I like the sound of that.
Yeah, the thing might end up costing a little bit more, working a whole lot better, and being a whole lot more future-proof.
And there's an LED backlight as well.
There's a humdinger. Rip schnorter.
It's a Perlaterra.
Are they selling on eBay?
Oh, yes.
Ah.
Not that type of guy.
You sound disappointed, Graham.
Entertaining.
Now, I'd like to introduce a conspiracy theory at this point in time because...
Oh, good.
Informative.
We've got another case here of a complete and utter lack of perspective.
Independent.
No, the couch is unbleepable.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Unbelievable.
It is unbelievable, you're right.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
And one of our regular people who contribute to Tech Talk Radio every week is Adam Turner. Adam writes for The Green Guide, The Sydney Morning Herald, and a lot of other
Well, he's one of Australia's leading freelance technology journalists.
He is, and we're very, very lucky, very proud to have him as part of Tech Talk Radio. And each week he sends us through stuff, which is really good. And last week it was Lost, which got everyone chatting, and even correspondence was entered into over that one. So,
but it wasn't just Lost. It was the treatment dished out to us by the free-to-air television networks.
Yeah, and why we all go to peer-to-peer in this country.
Are you going to watch Lost, Graham, now that there's an ending? We were worried for a while there that it just would never end.
But didn't that's all that we'd never get any answers, yes, because I remember... I persisted with it for around about a season, end of season one, and then season two started, and instead of getting any more answers, we just got more questions. Mm. So at that point, I gave up on it. But yeah, I might. I'm considering it.
Have you tried MasterChef?
No, I'm...
There's an ending.
I'm not considering that.
Every season has an ending.
Yeah, good.
I'm really over those variety shows. Better. Biggest Losers and Biggest Winners and...
Yep.
Give me Top Gear any day. Now, this is a good show.
Top Gear is a fantastic show.
I love it.
Channel 9 are slicing it to bits, I think.
Oh, so. Yeah, it's on Go, I think, at the moment. I think I caught a bit of it the other day.
Just download it.
Yeah. Yep.
See, there's the issue, isn't it? Just download. That's the attitude.
Because you get it without Channel 9 slicing it to bits.
And that's right. And that's what the point that Adam made about what was going on with Lost. 1.4 million, I think it was, I'll stand corrected, but I think that's what he said in his view to the couch last week. Downloaded it because they just got so sick of what the networks were doing to it.
Yeah.
So, anyway, this week is no different. One of the major newspapers in the world, a very highly respected paper, is the New York Times. And, yes, I think Liz's actually claim to fame was that she... What did she do? Something with the New York Times, one of our US correspondent. She
put something bad, something controversial.
Anyway, we'll think about that and come back
we'll
after
get back
the break.
To you.
But yeah, exactly. But in the meanwhile, here's Adam's view from the couch. If you're an iPad user and a New York Times listener, listen up.
Why is the New York Times afraid of RSS? By demanding Apple pull the Pulse iPad RSS app, the New York Times is making a fool of itself in front of the online audience it so desperately wants to woo. For a publisher that's attempting to be on the cutting edge of new technology, the New York Times acted like a typical old-world dinosaur last week when it demanded Apple remove an iPad RSS reader called Pulse because it came preloaded with the newspaper's RSS feed. Now, RSS, or really simple syndication, is a standard format for subscribing to new content on a website, particularly news sites. You just take the RSS link and paste it into your RSS reader. You'll then be notified when new content is published. You'll either get the entire article or just the intro and a pic along with a link to the web page, depending on what the publisher wants to provide. You can also use RSS to provide multimedia content such as podcasts. In a world of constant format wars, RSS is the secret sauce that makes the web so great. These days, most browsers and email clients have a built-in RSS reader. Plus, there are a variety of standalone RSS apps and online RSS services. If you want to keep track of what's happening in the world, RSS is the answer. Now, the Pulse iPad app shows that RSS feeds don't need to be just a boring list of headlines. It's such an impressive app bringing together images and headlines and content from various RSS feeds that Steve Jobs even praised it at Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference. A few hours later, Pulse was pulled from the iTunes store at the request of the New York Times. The newspaper claimed Pulse, quote, infringes the New York Times company's rights, quote, even though the app merely displays the RSS feed that the New York Times chooses to make publicly available to anyone for free. Pulse comes preloaded with the main New York Times RSS feed, which just provides the headline and an intro. You can click on a button to see the full story on the New York Times homepage within the app, just as you would with any other browser. Pulse also comes preloaded with RSS feeds for a few other newspapers and blogs, plus you can add your own RSS feeds. Years ago, most newspapers made the decision to give away most, if not all, of their print content free on the web. The decision is often referred to as the media's original sin, because now people expect everything for free online and are buying less physical newspapers. Newspaper publishers are hoping the iPad will help atone for that sin by providing a platform on which they can charge for online content. Enter the New York Times. Apple has a very close relationship with the New York Times, with the paper even reformatting the video clips on its front page in time for the iPad launch to help Apple convince buyers that the iPad doesn't need Adobe's Flash video player. The New York Times also produced one of the first iPad news apps, which is heavily featured in Apple's iPad marketing campaign. Each company is hoping to leverage the other to get a strong foothold in the brave new world of digital news. The New York Times offers a free iPad app with limited content, but it has plans for expansion. Other publishers are already charging for their iPad apps. The challenge they face is that they're still giving away the content for free on their websites and via RSS. The iPad's mobile Safari browser is so impressive that it often provides a better newspaper reading experience than the iPad apps, offering access to more stories and making it easier to browse content. Even some of the iPad RSS readers, such as Pulse, offer a better reading experience than some of the newspaper's dedicated iPad apps. So you get what we have here, a media giant crushing an iPad app designed to give you access to the content that the newspaper chooses to give away. Pulse's developers are charging $5 Australian for the app, although you can't really claim that they're trying to resell the newspaper's content. The New York Times has also complained because Pulse frames the paper's web pages rather than showing them full screen. It displays the pulse menus across the bottom of the webpage with links to other New York Times stories. There are plenty of other RSS readers for sale on the web and even in the iTunes store that perform similar tricks to Pulse. Are the paper's lawyers going to chase them all? Or is the iPad a special case because the New York Times is suddenly feeling the pinch of the original sin, yet continues to commit that sin by giving away content via RSS and the website? The New York Times actions are the same as if a rock band put on a free concert in the park and then sued people for selling binoculars to the crowd. The online content is there for free for the world to see. Pulse's only crime is that it's too good, offering a better view of the New York Times free content than in a newspaper's own iPad app. Maybe it should hire Pulse's developers rather than trying to crush them. The New York Times is fully entitled to switch off its RSS feeds and even shut down its website if it wants to protect its content. But if it's going to use free tools such as RSS to give away its content, it can't well complain if someone designs an RSS reader to view that free content. The app is not even giving away the full story, just the headline, with Pulse users clicking to view the full story on the New York Times website. Pulse is the most downloaded RSS reader for the iPad and has actually gained the New York Times 35,000 RSS subscribers in just a few weeks. Subscribers who click on the headline to view the New York Times website and the ads. So Pulse is actually making money for the New York Times by providing ad views, with the paper not having to lift a finger. So getting back to that free rock concert, the New York Times is attacking someone who is charging a few bucks for a shuttle service to drive 35,000 extra people to the park. People who are going to buy a t-shirt, ensuring the band makes plenty of money from its free gig. The New York Times attack on Pulse is a textbook example of how, even after a decade, arrogant media giants are still struggling to come to terms with the web and failing to understand the fundamentals of the technology. The fact that it's the New York Times, which parades itself on the iPad as a shining example of new media attacking RSS, makes this situation even more laughable. It seems Apple feels the same way because after a few hours, Pulse returned to the iTunes store unchanged. For how long, no one knows. It's not the first time Apple has removed an app in order to appease a partner, only to reinstate the app and then later pull it again. According to a New York Times spokesman, "We think it has been reinstated by error. We have asked Apple for an explanation." The explanation is simple. The New York Times is an old-world dinosaur that can't even comprehend the changes happening around it. Moronic decisions such as attacking RSS readers don't bode well for the paper's digital future.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
RSS is a wonderful thing. You just have to use it correctly, I think. And, yeah, Adam's nailed it there. Great way to get stuff around. But, yeah, really? Nick your application off the site and put it back again? And, yeah, anyway.
He's right, too. New York Times is still running on a very, very old media model, I suppose. They need to get with it. It's the Times.
Typical of what happens when...
It's not just restricted to the print media, let me tell you.
Typical of what happens when a large organisation just doesn't understand the technology they're using.
Mm.
It's just a failure to understand the nature of their own RSS feed.
Mm. Anyway, there you go. That's Adam Turner.
View Thanks, from the Adam. Couch. Very Thanks. Good.
Really good.
Adam sent me a text message too in that break.
Yeah. Go there. Let's talk about Twitter, shall we, just for a moment.
Who picked the music? Sorry.
It was you. Good.
That's all right. Yes. Twitter.
Yes, served its purpose.
Oh, good.
Twitter, yes, has fallen apart, not unlike the Australians in the World Cup.
It's fallen apart?
Yeah, Twitter's labouring under the load of World Cup tweets at the moment.
It's having more growing pains.
Oh, absolutely. But anyway.
I frequently go to Twitter and find it's complaining that there's too many requests going on or something like that, yeah.
The picture of the whale being held up by about half a dozen sparrows.
I thought it was getting held up by the bowls of petunias.
Ah, yes, Douglas Adams.
Yeah.
Yeah, could do. Anyway, for those of you who aren't Hitchhikers fans, we'll move on.
Please.
Graham's looking very glazed over there. A couple of interesting people worth following at the moment. I saw this pop out during the course of the week. People worth following. BP's global PR. Now, these are fake global PR companies. Obviously, you're aware of the oil spill because oil spills in on our chat this evening. But yes, there's a one there worth following, BP's global PR. Obviously, they're having a lot of success plugging that leak in the Gulf of Mexico.
And is this a fake BP or a real
fake
one?
BP, yeah.
BP Global PR, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So make sure you do that. With no shortage of official commentary to bounce off BP fumbles through its response to the deep... You're reading it, obviously.
Adopt a BP oil plume. $25.
Oh, no.
$25 makes you 100% responsible for an oil plume. Oh, dear. We shouldn't laugh. Yes.
Yes.
We will, though. Yeah, go on, Andrew. Sorry.
Sorry, I've lost my place now.
We respect your outrage. We just don't believe it's sustainable. There's some very, 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 very funny fake accounts, aren't there? And not just BP.
No, not just BP. Godwin Gregg. Remember him, or Gretsch?
Godwin Gretsch, yes, yes.
He was the man who...
Gregg, I think.
Gregg?
Utegate.
Yeah, Utegate. He was one that was worth having a bit of a look at too. But anyway, I won't go into a huge amount of them, but they're just two that are worth having a look at. And of course, there's the fake Stephen Conroy. Who I used to follow for a while there, but I got bored with him after a while.
Yeah, but he's got strong competition for the incredible inanity of the real Stephen Conroy.
He does. He does. If you're following a fake one out there and you reckon it's funny, just jump online and tell us about it. Come into the chat if you're listening live. chat.techtalkradio.com.au or send us an email, feedback@techtalkradio.
The BP Global PR one has got nearly 162,000 followers. Isn't that fantastic?
Yeah, it's up there with the spacecraft people from Japan. I was having a look on their tweets the other day. It's in Japanese. My kanji's not good.
No.
But I think they were about one in three tweets were in English, and the others were all in Japanese. So
Babelfish translates Japanese from.
Can I borrow yours?
No. Babelfish on the web.
.com or whatever it is.
Yeah, babelfish.yahoo.com.
But is it worth going there for 128 of the best characters? Probably not. Even Google does translation now too, by the way. You can translate this in the toolbar.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Yeah, that works up really the top. Well.
Yeah. I should give it a go, actually, now I think of it. And it's while we're speaking of Google, what a segue. They've unleashed caffeine in their index tool. Do you know what caffeine is?
I know very well what caffeine is.
Is it picking up some black stuff? I have mine hot.
Pick up my mug of coffee here. Know about caffeine.
Well, basically, caffeine is a stimulant, and that's in pretty much what Google's doing to try and improve the response time of their search. And they've launched the new indexing tool to build and maintain the company's flagship search engine. Obviously, as we've alluded to, it's been called Caffeine. The new search will aim to speed up the speed at which the massive Google search index refreshes itself.
They're going to speed up the speed.
Speed up the speed. You used to be able to go in there and tell yourself to be crawled slower, but obviously now they're going to alter that the way they do it, which will probably keep it a tad more current, which I thought was pretty good anyway, but maybe that's going to change the way it's indexed.
It's amazing to see how fast Google does index new content, isn't it? Have you ever done a science experiment like that? You put a new blog post up or a new content.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and then give it what, a couple of minutes or something and search for it in Google.
Or set up a Google alert on your own content,
yeah,
so that you can see when it updates in the Google thing.
Yeah. And within minutes, bang, it's been indexed. It's available.
Anyway, rather than to look to index large portions of the web at a time, Caffeine will find smaller updates to individual pages and files and use that information to maintain the search index.
Okay, yep.
So there you go. That's Caffeine. Watch for it coming to a cafe near you. The Google shop near you. Now, a little bit of feedback from last week's show. Sorry, not feedback. Follow-up is probably the word. You remember last week when we talked about Facebook and the contact the federal police button that we all laughed and scoffed at?
Yeah,
well, apparently it's going to happen. Facebook policy consultant Moselle Thompson acknowledged the Australian Federal Police's call for a new law enforcement enactment button as a formal request.
Oh, no.
The AFP told the media late last month and again this week that it had requested that Facebook establish a local point of contact. But in a meeting of the Parliamentary Joint Secretary Committee on Cyber Safety in Melbourne...
In which AFP's request was completely misunderstood.
Thompson said he was unaware the AFP had put in a formal request. So it's going around in circles. It's good, huh?
No, it's not good. It's bad. It's bad, bad, bad. It's a silly waste of time.
I reckon Conroy
click here on a link on every Facebook page and the Australian Federal Police will be notified.
Yeah.
That you're concerned about something.
It'll go in someone's inbox and they'll never get to it.
Why don't we set up a VoIP call to 000 at the same time and,
That's a good idea, Dr.
Yeah. Do a screen grab of your screen and capture all of your last 100 emails you've received and send it to Mr. Conroy.
Well, once Conroy gets everyone, logging URLs, you'll be fine. The paper trail's good. You just go back and see who's been to where and done what.
It's bizarre. What are these people thinking? They're not thinking, are they?
No. Anyway, Google posts Chrome security fixes. Chrome has had a few issues of recent times and has been issued with a fresh round of security updates. The company said that 5.0.375.70, make note of those
numbers.
It's
easy for you to say.
Absolutely. would address 11 vulnerabilities in the Chrome release for Windows, Mac, and Linux. Now, Graham, you're a very good believer, of strong believer in, of Chrome.
Well, I'm a user of Chrome.
Well, you tout its values more than you would across a few others for speed, if no other reason.
Yep.
But are there any vulnerabilities that you've really noticed with it? I guess like
all
web browsers, really, isn't it? That's the weakest link.
It's a normal thing for there to be security updates and so on to software like this. I mean, Internet Explorer has them, Firefox has them, Safari has them. It's part of the game.
It's funny, last patch Tuesday, which tends to take things down if you've got it set to automatically reboot. The Apple, I think, had more patches come out on their patch Tuesday than Microsoft did last week for their Safari browsers and stuff like that.
Okay.
I thought that was quite ironic, but nonetheless.
I got suckered into installing some malware today through Google Chrome. Can I tell you about that little experience?
Please do. Do tell. Yeah. What, not a search bar or something for some unknown company?
No, it was that horrible fake antivirus, the one that pops up and says, oh, we've detected a virus on your system and we're scanning it now and do you want to continue with this? And you try and run something and it will not run. It just pops up this pop-up and says that this program is infected.
Yep.
I think what I did was I went to a website of the week, which we spoke about a month ago, called Grooveshark.
Oh, yeah.
Which is that music listening site. And I was on Grooveshark and I
use that now. That's good.
Well, I did something on Grooveshark and I got a message from Chrome, and I'm sure it was a legitimate message. Maybe it wasn't. I thought it was at the time. And it said, a plugin is required for this to work properly. Do you want to install this plugin? And I thought it was a legitimate Chrome prompt. And
it was a legitimate Chrome prompt, but the plugin wasn't really needed by the website you're at.
Okay, so something through Grooveshark prompted me to do that, and I clicked yes, and Chrome just went into a zombie state, and I thought, oh, Chrome's gone to hell. I'm going to have to close it and restart it. You have to do that very often. I thought, that's a bit odd, but anyway, we'll give it a go. And I got the warning saying that Chrome has become unresponsive. Do you want to close this tab? And I said, yes. And as soon as I did that, and I opened up something again, bang, started getting all this stuff popping up saying, you've got viruses. And I thought, oh no, where did this come from?
Okay.
Spent the next hour disinfecting the machine.
Now, it probably did happen when you visited the Grooveshark site, but I strongly suspect it wasn't Grooveshark's fault directly.
Okay.
You're saying they've been hijacked.
I'm betting that you don't have a Grooveshark account. When you go to Grooveshark, you have an advertisement appear down the right-hand side of the page.
Ah, I do have an account, but don't have like a premium
account.
Don't
have a paid
account. Correct, that's correct.
So you get the advertisement on the side of the page.
Yes, I do.
Okay, now, those advertisements won't be directly controlled by Grooveshark. There'll be some advertising company that supplies that to them.
Do you think I've inadvertently clicked on something pane?
I don't think you've even inadvertently clicked on it. I think that pane has tried to display.
It's been foisted upon you.
It's tried to load this plugin that Chrome has prompted you about.
Mm.
And when you've said yes, you've downloaded that plugin that the ad requested. Mm. And you haven't realised that it's the ad that's requesting it and not the main page you're looking at.
That could have been what's
happening. And what happens is these bad guys, let's just call it, bad guys, trademark, they submit these fake ads that contain the malware to all the advertising companies, and the advertising companies do their very best to filter them all out, and every now and then one gets through and gets posted on an otherwise legitimate website. And this is how a lot of malware gets spread, by people without necessarily going to, seedy, dodgy web pages.
AdBlock Pro is a wonderful plugin for Firefox. I don't know whether it's available for Chrome. It probably is.
On the other hand, if you
get rid of those things.
If you like Grooveshark and you're enjoying the service, the ad down the side is what's paying for it. And if you're blocking that, then you're not paying for your use of Grooveshark.
I'm not paying for my use of Grooveshark then.
So, question is that...
I have that because it drives me crazy when you go to newspaper sites and everything is thrown upon you, and it's like when you're trying to read something and you've got everything else dancing around on the screen in front of you, it becomes incredibly frustrating. So,
Damo the Greek in the chat room agrees with you, Andrew. AdBlock Pro, Dr. On, says Damo, and Warlock says it was Flash that did it.
On my camera. Absolutely. Speaking of Flash...
What I would contend, sorry, before you move on, Andrew... Grooveshark, we've all said it's a great service. We all love it. We've all used it since it was the website of the week the other week. The account to pay for a paid account is not that much. I would submit that it's worth paying for it. Get rid of the ad and problem solved, rather than blocking the ad and using it for free, which I think is a tad on the unpleasant side for a site that you like.
And just quickly, if you get infected with one of these things and you want to disinfect yourself, just restart in safe mode. I'd recommend using something like SpyBot Search and Destroy. Run it a couple of times and then reboot.
Is that what you did?
That's what I did, and that cleaned it up.
Yeah, there's a couple of really good ones. There's I might get a little bit of a list together and we'll talk about at some stage some of the good sort of cleanup tools for when this stuff does happen to you.
Because it's maddening, absolutely maddening when it happens.
SpyBot SD. I love that.
Search and Destroy.
It's a good one,
though. Yeah, it's been around a long while. It is a good one, but there's a couple of others that are really good floating around at the moment as well. So that might be a topic for a bit later on.
There's been a few nasty voiceware, even for the clean up your PC, like some of the more reputable companies have tried to do this, like especially with toolbars. You go and install an application. Would you like the semantic this, or would you like the this or that, or would you whatever?
Yep.
It's like, no, get off my machine.
Yep. And I count the Google toolbar as one of the worst of these. That's voiceware. You don't need it. There's no point in having it. All its functions are built into other things these days.
Translate things for you.
Well, no, my Chrome translates things for me without having the Google toolbar installed.
Lets you have side wiki so you can see what people are saying about your website.
Chrome is the Google toolbar.
Chrome, yeah, that's right. I don't need the Google toolbar. And it's foisted on you, but you're right. Both McAfee and Semantic are foisting scan tools on us at the moment that just sit there occupying machine resources for no good reason. Yeah, this is a really big tip. When Flash or Java or any of those things prompt you to install an update, make sure you read the screens as they go through and untick the boxes for all these extra things you don't need. Do not install them through that mechanism.
Don't just
even if you want the Google toolbar, don't install them through that mechanism.
Nerd alert! Nerd alert!
Even if you want the Google toolbar, don't install it through that mechanism because it only encourages the bastards.
Don't just click next, next, next is what Graham's saying.
That's right.
Read what you're clicking. Okay, nerd alert off. slash nerd alert. Andrew, where were you? Sorry, back to you.
Adobe Flash. Have you got your update? Speaking of foistware, have you had your...
it's another lovely segue. You've done well, son.
Have you been forced...
Taking a coroner award out of petty cash.
Have you been forced to put your new Adobe Flash Player update on there as they move in towards their new financial model?
Yeah, I got a reminder about it today while I was trying to remove this malware. So I said, Adobe, you are the last thing I need to contend with at the moment. Go away.
Yeah, exactly. I got that in the middle of it all too when I was building a machine the other day with a 64-bit. Adobe has released the final build of Flash 10.1 and Air 2 for Windows, Mac and Linux, along with a bundle of other patches for existing code. And anyway, apparently 10.1 for Android will be released later this month. Obviously, there's not a Mac version there, although they have said OS X, so just not on some of the other things. All right. So watch out for that update coming through as well too. But I think there's more underlying stuff there that Adobe just not coming up with reasoning why they're moving to new Flash players for paid content delivery and things like that. But hey, let's not start conspiracy theories here just yet. Optus, the telephone company that we all love and respect. Last week we talked about them hiding the word. They haven't been in front of the court yet, but they're using the word unlimited a lot in their mobile phone plans, which is a tad misleading. This week they're going to have a go at Telstra over coverage maps. Now, if you haven't seen it or not, you know how you go to the Telstra site and you can see the map of where they cover, where their mobile Next G covers and stuff?
It's everywhere you need it.
There's another overlay you can get, which is Optus's coverage.
On the Telstra site.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'll be taking that with a grain of salt, whatever they... Yeah.
Oh, yes, take it with a grain of salt, but they're certainly highlighting the fact that Optus's coverage just doesn't quite cut it compared to what Telstra has.
Yeah, yep.
Anyway, Optus have got their knickers in a knot, and they're considering taking legal action over that. But, yes, I had a chuckle when I saw that come up the other day. I thought, oh, that's straight to the heart, isn't it?
If I was Telstra, I would be taking Optus's data, whatever they want to claim, that's fine. Because their coverage is, even with the Optus's most optimistic figures, the Telstra's coverage is still going to be better.
Well, that was evident on this chart. Mm. And I think that Telstra were probably trying to do the community a bit of a favour and sort of say, well, look, this is really where it is. And to me, the maps looked relatively legit, you know. It was concentrated in the city areas and there was nothing in part of the rural areas and stuff like that.
Yeah, so. No, that's the one thing I'll always defend with Telstra. I mean, there's a lot of things we can attack Telstra about. But you pay a premium, but you do get a better service for it.
Hey, listen, they've actually, I'm not going to go and wave the flag for them or anything like that, but they've actually released some new plans for mobile phones in just the last week, which is actually what I would consider being competitive. Certainly, they're just marginally more. You're paying the premium for the better network, but gee whiz, they've changed their tune. Mr. Thodey, you've done well there, my friend.
I went for a drive down to South Gippsland a few weeks ago, down South Gippsland Highway and down the Bass Highway, and I think my mobile phone coverage got as far as about Cranbourne. That was it. On 3,
yeah,
nothing, absolutely nothing, not a sniff of signal for hours.
Well, ever since Telstra fell off the map when it came to 3, they're using 3 and Vodafone. I noticed there was something in the press too about Vodafone having issues with Apple handsets at the moment too. So instead of handing off to Telstra's 2G network, they're handing off to Vodafone's whatever network. It's just not working. I can drive in the main parts of Melbourne just a few kilometres from the city centre and you lose signal. It'll come up and say searching for, you know, kilometres while you're driving down the road.
Yep, I'm faced with the same dilemma. I'm shortly going to have to go for a trip up to where the snow country in Victoria, towards Brighton and Mount Hotham and that sort of area. And I know that my 3 mobile broadband just isn't going to work up there.
It's not going to cut it.
And I'm going to have to do something different. I'm going to have to get a Telstra service to be able to be online while I'm up there.
Very cost effective now, or more so than they've
absolutely
ever been.
Absolutely, they've really improved their service.
Absolutely, yeah. 7,000 base stations too. That's a lot. I don't know how the others stack up to that, but 7,000 little towers is a pretty amazing thing. And I think we had a website of the week a while back where you can actually go and see online Telstra's towers. I'm just trying to bring it up on the screen here. One very engineering-type person got very carried away and used a map. So, you know, how you can do meshes for Google Maps.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, this guy's going to put all the...
We've got an overlay of all the
overlay
towers.
Overlay of all the towers on Google Maps.
And that's a good idea.
If you want to have a look at it, as he drags his little notebook here so I can read it, because it's very small on my screen. If you go to http://cellsite.nudge.id.au, you can see it. It just brings up all these little red pins and search around, and you can see what services are on what tower. So I suspect they've just overlaid the...
Well, we had that as a website of the week, didn't we?
I think we did. Yeah. They're just taken the ACMA database and overlaid all the pins and dots and stuff like that.
Someone did something similar for all the telephone exchanges so you could tell what your ADSL coverage was going to be.
Now, there's a great website for that, adsl2exchanges.com.au.
Yeah.
Is really good, and it actually shows you on maps...
How do you know all this stuff?
ADSL2exchanges.com.au is a fantastic website for finding out what exchange services, what area, and how long the cable is between your house and the telephone exchange.
Yeah, you can see the hot zone where you're going to get good speeds and the zone where the speed's not going to be so good.
Oh, stick with us, guys. So, you're just typing that in, are you, Dr.
Ryan? I can remember when I was first getting into technology, and I was very into radio, as we all were in this room. And the big thing with real estate was you had to be on top of the hill. You had to have a good site for your antenna. And now it's all gone. It's how close to the telephone exchange you are. How good can you get your ADSL speeds? It's all changed.
Hasn't it? Indeed. The ACMA, the Australian Communications and Media Authority, has launched a spam SMS reporting tool.
Yay.
For those of you who get spam to your mobile phones, obviously just make sure that you, it's probably not from your phone carrier because they tend to reserve the rights to send you SMSs, but nonetheless, complain away. I think it's a good idea. But ACMA is inviting Australians to forward their SMS spam to 0429 999 888. That number again, 0429 999 888.
Give it a ring, Graham, see who answers.
No, I'm keying it in. I want this. This is great.
Okay. Now, launched last week, the new spam SMS service is expected to provide a simple, convenient way to alert ACMA of potential breaches of the Spam Act. Because I know my mum gets party invitations. I reckon that's the result of a previous SIM owner before she got her SIM for her thing. But then again, it's been relatively recent, so maybe not. But she's been getting all these strange spams from parties. She's not that. She doesn't go to those anymore. She's a bit old.
Whenever you drop your business card in a jar to go in the drawer for a free meal, or you don't ever
put those things in the fish and chip shop.
Enter one of those competitions. Put the ones at the supermarkets and the fish and chip shops and those things where you fill in the form to win a... a holiday to Fiji or whatever it might happen to be. Yeah, it's all of those.
Open invitation to direct marketing.
It's not just that direct marketing is a sideline. They get your address from it. That's the whole purpose of it, is to get your address. The same thing with the win a PlayStation on the side of a Coke bottle. The whole point is to get permission to send you marketing.
I have a VoIP number which I use at work for all my outbound calls. And last week I had a telemarketer on. You can always tell when it's a telemarketer because none of the other phones in the office ring. It's just the number on the particular in-dial number that you get. And you just stand around the office. Anyone in the mood for a telemarketer or what? Anyway, I did answer it on this occasion, and the telemarketer was from some guy.
He was cruel.
An English-speaking gentleman from somewhere in the city of which we reside.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm just ringing up about that competition that you the survey you did a couple of weeks back. I'm going, what survey? You know, the one that you did a couple of weeks back. He couldn't tell me the name of the survey, but he told me that I'm just ringing up because of that survey that I did. I'm going, I didn't do a survey. And then I promptly said, where are you calling from? And by that stage, he hung up.
Now, this is my strategy. When you've got a few minutes to spare,
it's a lot of fun.
The best strategy to deal with these guys is to tie them up on the phone for as long as possible.
It gets their benchmarks down.
It'll strongly discourage them from calling you again because they just don't want to deal with it.
Anyway, the communications regulator, ACMA that is, reports a 71% increase in SMS spam complaints 2008, 2009, and a 12% increase in the first 11 months of this year compared to previous years. So if you're getting spam sent to your mobile phone and it's driving you crazy, just forward it on to, here's that number again, 0429 999 888, which is the Australian Communications and Media Authority's spam reporting text line.
But when you forward a text message, it doesn't send, it's not like email where you can see a trail of where it's come from. It's just going to look like a message that's come from your phone to them.
That's right. But at the end of the day, they're probably looking at the content, aren't they? You know,
they're trying
if it's company X selling this or some telco selling that, they're going to know who it is.
They want to find out if it's a one-off or if it's one of 100,000 that's been sent, maybe.
Here's something else funny too. BP's buying ads, AdWords on Google.
Yes.
They're buying AdWords for oil spill.
Oh.
I just thought I'd throw that in. I think that's really quite funny.
This is the same BP that's running the BP Global PR Twitter account,
probably,
is it?
Yes, probably. Probably buying AdWords up there. That'd be quite good. So what are they doing at the moment? Adopt an oil plume or whatever it was. That was quite funny, really, wasn't it?
Yes. Good. Well, how's the BP share price at the moment? I reckon some bargains to be snatched up.
I don't know. Depends on what currency it's in. If it's in Hong Kong dollars, it might be a bit...
Do you think it is a bargain, though, or is there a possibility that the weight of all the compensation they're going to have to pay could be a serious issue for them in the future?
Analysts are saying that this could be a deal-breaker for BP.
Exactly.
It's got all the hallmarks of, you know, the other oil companies are circling at the moment, saying that we might be able to buy a very cheap British petroleum here in the next few months.
This spill is bigger than the Exxon Valdez spill, which I think up until now has been the biggest spill in the history of oil spills.
Yeah, and they're still cleaning up from the Exxon Valdez disaster. Mm, they're still having problems.
They're talking about ramifications for the British economy as a whole as well because of the power of BP in that equation.
But it's interesting to see how long these guys take to come to justice and all that and what sort of justice it comes to. Because I think also during the week, the Indian Bhopal, you know, the Union Carbide issue, that finally came through the courts over in the other side of the world too. And that was decades ago. LimeWire. You're a user of LimeWire, aren't you, Dr. Ron? I think we all are in the course of time. We all know what it is and what it does.
Yeah, now that was also a good segue because I saw a funny tweet, which I'm going to try and find really quickly here, which equated LimeWire with BP. Let me find it. Go on, you talk amongst yourselves.
Okay, LimeWire is facing a takedown effort from the RIAA, which is the Recording Industry Association of America.
LimeWire owes $1 billion, but BP is only on the hook for a $69 million fine. Therefore, music sharing is 14.5 times more damaging to the world than a catastrophic oil spill.
But that puts it into perspective,
doesn't it? I thought so, yes. Ridiculous. Sorry,
guys. Absolutely. according to media reports, the RIAA recently filed a request in the Southern New York U.S. District Court seeking a permanent injunction against the service, which is accused of continuing to enable users to illegally share copyrighted music content. One of the many, but yes, that's probably the case. So they're going to have a tackle at LimeWire now.
LimeWire is one of the ones we used to use to get music before we realized BitTorrent was better.
Absolutely. Didn't you?
Is that right?
And then BitTorrent.
Sorry, but
from a technological point of view.
I'm sure I meant to say before we realised that we may as well just buy it from iTunes.
That's right.
Yes. That's what I meant to say.
What you meant to say. That's what we all heard. Yes, the BitTorrent is technologically more sophisticated than LimeWire. You're right.
Yes.
Internode undercuts iNet Primus on the Tassie fibre plans too, if you're in Tasmania. Yeah. Make sure you have a bit of a look up for iNet's pricing because they've Internode has piped iNet and Primus to offer cheap plans for their national broadband trial in Tassie, starting at $30. The largest plan is $139 for 200 gig, 100 meg down and 8 megs up.
Does the word unlimited feature in there anymore?
No, only if it's not an Optus ad, I'm afraid. You might get unlimited in something else, but not in that particular sort of thing.
Good.
Ah, dear. Now, what else was I going to talk about tonight? XP, Windows XP. Graham, we touched briefly on this during the course of the time.
We did talk about Windows XP.
With the advent of Windows 7 going to Service Pack 1, should organisations be thinking about moving on from Windows XP? Is it time, do you think, for people to say, righto, XP, you've done us proud since 2000.
Well, yeah, it's getting there.
2000 or
it
whatever
really
it was.
Is. And as I said, with the licensing issues coming along as well with Service Pack 1, yeah, it's definitely time. The organisations, now's the time to be setting up your virtual labs or whatever, to be doing the testing, to find out what's going on. And, get Windows 7 onto the business network.
Because a couple of things which need to be taken into consideration is XP is not expected to be supported beyond 2012. And 50% of all enterprise XP users should patch the OS even faster before SP2 support runs out on the 13th of July this year. Were you aware of that?
SP2?
SP2.
Yeah, yep. We got SP3, that's right.
Yep. So, but you're probably also aware that some government departments are still running IE6.
Oh, look, I wouldn't be surprised if there's some very controlled environments out there still running NT4, but...
What about Windows 98? Should we go there?
No.
Okay, we won't. Anyway, but there's is there a rush really to install Windows 7, given that XP cutoff date is almost 4 years away? Or is it worth just hanging around waiting for things to just go from strength to strength? You yourself mentioned, Graham, earlier on in the show, that most corporations wait for Service Pack 1 to roll out before they deploy it in a big way.
Yeah.
Do you reckon that's going to happen this time around?
Maybe.
Yeah?
Yeah. I think Microsoft are trying to drive it too, as I said, with their licensing.
Very good. Apple also released Safari 5 for Mac and Windows. Are there any Safari users here?
Yeah, no.
No? See, JD's not in tonight.
He hasn't said much tonight. Oh, he's not here.
Haven't you noticed?
I thought he was quiet over there.
I thought he was quiet. Yes, his seat's very empty too. He'll be coming back next week.
Will he? Oh, good. Apple is updating Safari browsers with new features, including speed boost, multiple search options, and a new reader software that supports HTML5, no mention of Flash. The company said that the updated Nitro JavaScript engine in Safari 5 had a 30% speed improvement over Safari 4. That's not bad. Do you reckon? I must admit, I do like the Safari browser for rendering quality stuff. It looks good in Safari. I've always found that to be the case, being web developer type sort of people as well.
Yeah, so, there's probably some validity to that.
The fonts look great. Yeah, you don't get jagged edges and you don't get silly looking grungy things. But anyway, that's coming up. Safari 4, or should I say, 30% speed improvement with this new script engine, which 3% advantage over Google's Chrome and doubles the speed of Firefox. DNS prefetching and caching of previously viewed pages also boosts the browser's speed, which is also going to be detrimental to developers because as people load them up, they go, it hasn't changed yet. And you go, Control-F5 and whatever it is.
Control-R to refresh.
Yeah.
Warlock in our chat room says he used Safari on his new MacBook Pro for about 2 days. And it annoyed him too much, and he installed Firefox.
Wonder why. I know. I guess.
Explain yourself, Warlock.
No Flash? Would that be it?
Don't know.
Yeah. Okay, what else? Just briefly, Microsoft Adobe fixed security flaws. Biggest patch Tuesday out, which we've talked about just recently. Adobe Systems separately said that it was going to issue an update to its Flash player, which it's done. So everyone's probably seen patches and updates to Microsoft and Apple and Adobe stuff across the course of the last week.
I've seen a couple of notifications come in and a couple of upgrade opportunities for me.
Excellent. In other news, just briefly, the government holds the line on the ACTA talks. And paraphrasing that,
What we're actually doing in a lot of respects is saying that there's no safe harboring for non-ISPs when it comes to content on systems. So, you know, at the moment we had iiNet go through the courts and basically they sort of got taken to the cleaners, or they were going to be taken to the cleaners over the fact that their users were using peer-to-peer.
Yes.
And that they were going, that what happened was that AFACT were trying to hold the company responsible, iiNet being the provider of the internet, responsible for what their users,
what their
were,
users
doing.
Were doing on the network. Yes.
Yeah. Well, if you're a university, beware, you are responsible. And if you are providing it through a business, or which is a non-ISP, I'm assuming a non, someone who's not a licensed telecommunications provider, then you are held responsible for that. Well, that's what they're pitching anyway. That'll be interesting, won't it? So that'll make universities, because we know what uni students are like, don't we now, boys?
Well, it'll be, yeah, I don't know. Mm. This is very odd. It's very strange where we're headed. Graham's right. I mean, there's no recourse to any due process whatsoever with sort of stuff.
Very worrying trend.
It is. Odd spot. Gadget website of the week coming up after this.
Suffering sucky tech. This has to be the best technology show on the internet. Tech Talk Radio.
I'm not sure that they're driving competition out of the whole marketplace.
Well, no, they won't take a definitive stance on that either.
You don't win elections, you lose them.
Who's in the limelight for all the wrong reasons is the question.
Oh, so, but it's great. That's outside Australia.
Lots of girls on the floor there doing development.
Flash is available for free, and I can develop on it for free, can I?
No.
Most modern name servers dealt with that without even blinking.
Entertaining.
That's very hard to do when it's...
It really is hard to simulate it.
Informative.
It's a glorified phone, but it's...
Independent.
That's their own stupidity.
That's exactly right.
I agree.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
See, there's some things you just gotta do.
Listening to Tech Talk Radio.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics.
Cool! This thing is amazing!
Tech Talk Radio's Gadget of the Week.
Out of my hole!
Now, at the start of the show, I said, listen up if you're interested in a different type of media streamer for home. We were banging on about the Western Digital device, but have a listen to this little doohickey, gadgety gadget. It's Xiva's, X-I-V-A's, Music Mate. Music M8 is the product name. The Music Mate is an advanced, dedicated entertainment server and a great way to store your precious music collection, photo memories, movie clips, and more. Use Music Mate with your favourite music streaming product to play music wherever and whenever you want it. It's got a plug-and-play solution out of the box, an automated backup facility simply by adding an external drive, web browser configuration interface so you can control it from any web browser, automatic network shares, user creation of network
shares.
That's
handy. Automatic network shares.
Absolutely.
So it works out whether it's got a music folder or something like that.
It does, and it just magically appears on your network. It's got a photo browser and viewer.
So you don't need iTunes or Windows Media or anything like that?
Nope. All you need is your web browser. It's got auto camera backup, online upgrades, and
Mac,
Linux, XP, and Vista compatible. All bases are covered. 1 terabyte of storage. Integrated high-quality slot-loading DVD drive and Ethernet, VGA, USB and PS2 interfaces. I found them on eBay.
PS2?
Yep, everything. So you can plug anything you like into it. I found them on eBay for a bit over $1,000 Australian.
Yeah, they're pricey.
Yeah, but you've
got to be desperate.
Yeah. Well, yes and no. Have a look at my...
When you get a PlayStation or other ones for sub-200?
Well, I don't do storage, I suppose, is the answer, whereas this got one. Has 1 terabyte of storage.
Ah, I see. It's built-in storage.
Built-in storage. Have a look at that. It might be a good little gadget for you.
Get a NAS.
Xiva's Music Mate, the Music M8, and you can see that it's www.xiva.com/musicm8.
Here it is, everybody. The world's greatest website.
Tech Talk Radio website of the week.
Bit of an educational website this week. www.nserc, N for November, serc.und.edu. This is the website of the National Suborbital Education and Research Centre. Now, .und.edu is the University of North Dakota. So NSERC is a unit of the university's Northern Great Plains Centre for People and the Environment. And they operate NASA's DC-8 Flying Research Laboratory. So it's a flying...
That's what they had over here for chasing this thing, this Japanese...
Exactly.
Hayabusa.
Exactly. They were chasing the Hayabusa.
That's the one.
The Japanese... probe that re-entered into Earth's atmosphere.
Last night,
yeah.
I stayed up for it, but I couldn't see it.
Now, the DC-8 laboratory is considered... it's a scientific laboratory in which traditional missions Realized is the website. It's operated as a national facility capable of conducting research anywhere in the global atmosphere. There's information on this website about their current projects. There's media and press releases, electronic presentations, video presentations, there's mission lists, mission blogs, all sorts of good stuff. So if you're into that sort of thing, thanks very much, GD, for suggesting that as a website.
Yeah, GD's been very prolific in respect to space stuff this week. Oh, good on you, GD. It's been great.
It's been great. That's our website, Andrew, www.nserc.und.edu.
There is a fine line between genius and madness.
Missed it by that much.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Don't ask! For God's sakes, don't ask!
Houston, we have a problem.
The Odd Spot on Tech Talk Radio.
Andrew, nobody likes getting a speeding ticket.
No, really.
But when Brian McCrory, 33 years old, he received a speeding ticket.
Allegedly, or was this confirmed?
No, he received a speeding ticket in Bluff City in Tennessee.
Bluff City?
Yeah. But he didn't just complain. He thought he'd buy the local police department's website just to show him. he received a $90 speeding ticket earlier this year for cruising through what he called a speed trap. So he went to the city police department's website to complain and to reschedule his court hearing. He saw that the site's content had been replaced with a notice saying that the domain was up for grabs. So he waited a few weeks, and then he pounced after a Tennessee Police Department. The Tennessee Police Department did let its website expire. He snatched up the site, and he now runs a site which shows a smiling cartoon police badge clutching greenbacks and allows people to post gripes who have been caught speeding. The website, if you're interested,
very good. Well done, there, man.
Is bluffcitypd.com, which cost McCrary $80, which was just $10 shy of his speeding ticket. That's our odd spot, Andrew.
That's very, very funny. It would never happen here, would it?
A story close to my heart. Website hijacking and all that sort of stuff.
Absolutely. Yes. It never happened here. Not with the vic.govs or the nsw.govs or anything, or qld.govs.
You'd hope not.
Yeah, it couldn't happen with those, unfortunately, because of the .gov...
Namespace
that's controlled in a different way. But
yeah,
yes.
But over there, obviously, it's a .com, isn't it?
But if you're a company, you've got a .com.au, and you forget to renew your domain, then yes, this could happen to you.
Doesn't matter how big you are or how small you are.
It's happened to some major players back in the day, too.
Mm. That's Tech Talk Radio for this week. Was it good for you?
Oh, it worked for me. It worked for you.
All right, we'll leave the stream up, and we'll be back same time next week. Until then, bye for now.
You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio, brought to you each and every week by a group of dedicated professionals from within the media, broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, panellists Justin Dunlop, Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins, expert opinion from Adam Turner, and our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Post-production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications, podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night at 8 p.m. from the studios of 3WBC. The crew wish to thank all the stations around Australia that take the show. Tech Talk Radio is available for syndication on your local station. For sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9818 2756 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, for more information. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.